left because he wanted to watch the Brett Favre game where the Vikings are winning, trouncing the Cowboys, what can I say? At 6 o'clock, we will have Rev. Julia Day from Victoria Island, British Columbia. At 7 o'clock, Regina Dawn Akers will be here, Holy Spirit Guides. 8:30, we will have Christian John Mioli. Comes here almost all the time, Christian John Mioli. The topic tonight will be the Piece de Resistance, which he says he borrows from the French, but it's going to be about the peace and the resistance. Of course, the miracles. And finally, at 10 o'clock, Dave Shock, the Way of Mastery. Thank you all. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, thank you for that, David. And I'm just going to do a quick sound check. Is the sound coming through all right? Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. Can someone type yes if they can hear me? Yes. All right. And I just wanted to note that Julie is not from Victoria Island. Victoria Island is just shy of the North Pole. Julie is from Vancouver Island, in the city of Victoria, from Vancouver Island, which is a long way from the North Pole. Anyways, I welcome everyone to our Sunday afternoon slot, where our focus is on the earliest written record of the Course in Miracles, which is found in two collections of Helen Shipman's manuscripts, her original shorthand notes, and her later edited transcripts, known as the Ear Text. Between these two documents, we have the whole of the original dictation, which has yet to come to light. What I've been doing lately is going through the notes and identifying material which didn't make it into the Ear Text and combining these two documents. The resulting document, therefore, is not any one of the known original five scribal versions, but rather a combination of the two earliest ones. It includes essentially the whole of the original dictation. The material does have some rough spots, some segments which were written down only in point form, and some sentences which were never completed. In other cases, the sequence of material appears to separate segments which were intended to be stuck together, and this material needs editing. However, despite those limitations, it also provides tremendous insight into the experience of that original dictation and the authentic teaching of A Course in Miracles. So what we're doing today will be a reading, some commentary, and discussion of that material. In the last, 6 weeks, we've gone through the first 46 pages of the Ear Text, which the notes material added. And we're going to pick up today on page 46. And I'm going to give you the URL of a copy that's online for anybody who wants to follow along with the reading or join with us in the reading. Sometimes that URL needs to be cut and pasted into your browser. Other times, if you click on it, it works. And I'm not sure why. And for those on the radio who can't see that URL, if you type www.miraclesinactionpress.com and then click on Scholar's Toolbox and go to the bottom of the menu that pops up, you'll get to that online copy of the original dictation. And Carmen is asking, did I ever find the Nothing Real summary in the notes? I don't know. What are you talking about, Carmen? And Silver Oceans, how did you get that material done if it was not written? Well, in fact, it was written. The material consists of Helen Shipman's original written shorthand notes, handwritten notes, and the earliest typed copy that she made of those, which is known as the Ear Text. And how did I get them? I don't actually know how I got them. They showed up in plain brown wrappers at my door after some years of asking everybody under the sun who I thought might know of where a copy could be obtained if they would send me one, and finally somebody did. Silver, the handwritten notes, were with the type here at the Library of Congress. Yeah, they still are, in fact, at the Library of Congress, and anybody can go to the Library of Congress and see them there after jumping through a few hoops and paying some money. But as for how, as I don't even know for sure if these are copies of what's there, because I've not been there to check. And I don't know if they are copies of what's there, how they got from there to me. However, they're here. And at this point, I'm going to hand the mic to Deborah to do her introduction, and then Carmen will get into your questions.
Hi everyone, can I be heard? Can you come through? Can somebody put up there a yes or a why or something? This is fun. Okay, you guys are very nice. I'm not saying anything. I mean, I just got hold of my phone and picked it up again. So, Doug, I put up a link there as well. I tested both of the links. The one that you put up there, you have to copy and paste. I don't know why what you're doing here. I haven't gone over them, but the one I put up does take me through. I don't know if that will take other people through or not. So, hi everybody. It's very nice to be here again. I'm always a bit anxious and very enthusiastic about all of this course study. It's so wonderful. So, again, I will request Holy Spirit
okay.
to be present so that we can bring online to Holy Spirit and come together and go with all of our experience stuff that will wait for us. And, Lord, heal me. And also, help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today. I really encourage this book. And I'll begin reading. So when you type, okay, what I'll do is copy and paste your, when you're talking, Doug, and have it prepared to post. And Carmen wanted to ask something. Carmen, I'll give you the mic and I'll get that link written down. Here's the mic.
Question, I guess I could go back to my question, if that's a big deal. Basically, you said that you hadn't seen the actual handwritten notes. I was at the Library of Congress and I saw that the stuff was vouchable, but the question that I had earlier was the summary statement that said popular that were often quoted, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, we're not to be surprised. I was wondering if that showed up in the handwritten notes anywhere because we didn't see the name of the typed parts of it. And I was just wondering, did you have to know? I don't. I was wondering the handwritten notes that you would come across that I really appreciate knowing. Thank you.
Okay, Carmen, thanks for the question. The reason why I don't know where the documents I have came from is that I haven't compared the documents I have to what's in the Copyright Office. I know there's a copy, there's a lot of stuff in the Copyright Office. I just don't know whether the stuff I have came from there or not because I haven't been able to compare the two physical objects to see if they're actually identical. And there's reason to believe they're not actually identical. There's several different copies of photocopies of material labeled Urtext in circulation, which are not all the same. And while they all appear to be multi-generational photocopies of the same original, just the kind of provenance through which they went from that original piece of paper Helen typed way back when to what we see on the net today is unknown to me. That's why I say I don't really know how the material I've been working with got here or how it compares to what's at the copyright office, except there's probably quite a bit of correspondence. The shorthand notes are on the website, www.miraclesinactionpress.com, through the toolbox link if you want to check them yourself. And much of it, aside from the workbook, is transcribed, so you don't actually have to read the handwriting. And no, the Nothing Real Can Be Threatened line, I haven't come across it anywhere in the shorthand notes. Ken writes of that material. He, in absence from Felicity, he has some, he's an extensive discussion of Helen's struggles with the first page. And how she didn't like the way Jesus originally dictated it, which started off with, you will see miracles through your hands through me. And persistently reworked it, as we see, the first page in the notes is quite different from the first page in the Ur text, which is quite different from the first page in the Hugh Lynn Casey version, which is very different from the first page in the later Foundation Bridgman. And Ken's description, for what it's worth, and I guess he was there at least through the last part, I mean, he was working with her through the last part of that revision, is that she kept asking Jesus for a new intro, and he kept giving her new ones. So, I don't think we're going to find that particular line in the notes. I don't think it was, you know, taken down in shorthand and then typed up. I think it was created or emerged in the process of reworking that first page multiple times. Now, if we are, for those who are wanting to follow along, if you are on the right page, you're going to see a blue box at the top of the screen that says The Course in Miracles, the original dictation, and on the left, a green sidebar, a navigation bar with section titles and page numbers. Those page numbers correspond to the Urtext manuscript copy I have. And they're being used here simply because they're conveniently sized for the purposes of jumping from page to page as we're working on this document online. And if you do want to check against the manuscript itself, they're that's where the page marks are here. That's where the manuscript page breaks actually exist. We finished last week at paragraph P1B41H. The real meaning of are of one kind is of one mind or will. And that entire discussion about the nature of creation. And starting at page 46, we're into an entirely new topic, which is why we decided to break there. And unless someone else has something to ask or comment on, I'm going to ask Deborah to begin the reading there.
Okay. 41J. Note that you do not need his help as a scribe, because you developed this ability by your own efforts, and finally placed them in my disposal. By lending you his strength, he strengthens himself. When he gains this through his own efforts, he will need your help in a very unexpected way. But this is just another example of the reciprocal nature of miracles. Go ahead, Doug.
It would be P1B41I, aside, tell Bill, that we want to start at here. In fact, second paragraph doesn't make sense until you've read that first paragraph.
Okay.
Thanks, Doug. I suppose I better tune in my listening capabilities a little bit finer because I missed you saying that. Sorry. So I'm going to start back here and I will continue into 41J again. So I'll start at 41I. I'm just going to grab my paper as my line guider here. I noticed I had missed it. Okay. Aside, tell Bill he is right in providing you with the consistent strength you need to get and he needs to offer. Your instability and his weakness have resulted from bad karmic choices, and your relationship now is crucial for the future. You must both exert every effort to restore it to what it once was. Both of you are correcting where you have failed before. This has already enabled you to fulfill a very unexpected role in your joint salvation and the salvation of many other children I will entrust increasingly to you. These are by no means chosen at random. Bill should know that his preparation is not only in terms of sharing in the results of your better application of some rather unusual talents. His role, which he will understand after his preparation is complete, will be equally surprising. He will need your help then, as you need his strength now. 41J, I will watch for your hand to go up, Doug, rather than blocking the answer. Note that you do not need his help as a scribe, because you developed this ability by your own efforts and finally placed them by my disposal. By lending you his strength, he strengthens himself. When he gains this through his own efforts, he will need your help in a very unexpected way. But this is just another example of the reciprocal nature of miracles. I see your hand, Doug, and I have one question to toss in there about is there any insight on how Helen went about developing her scribal ability? Here's the mic.
Thanks, Deborah. You developed this ability by your own efforts and finally placed them at my disposal. There are other references, I believe they come before this, to past communion, and we'll be getting into another, I believe it comes a little later here, the whole priestess bit. It looks to me, my understanding of what he's talking about is some past life cultivation of scribal abilities. Helen herself in 1974 or 5, in there somewhere, went with Bill and Ken to Israel, and they went to the Dead Sea Scroll caves at Qumran, and she reported having an experience of familiarity, that she recognized the place, but the sea level was different in her memory. She certainly, I think, had a sense that there had been some kind of past life experience in which her ability to channel had been cultivated. And there's a number of references in the notes and the Earth text that hint at that without any thorough discussion. But I think the important point for all of us right here is that Jesus is telling Helen that she doesn't need Bill's help as a scribe in terms of taking dictation, but that Bill needs her help as a scribe. And they both need each other for the project. The project really involves three people: Jesus, Bill, and Hillary. And all three are essential. And it's not going to happen without all three of them, which is summarized in the last line, but this is just another example of the reciprocal nature of miracles. The back and forth is essential. And for those who've been with us in previous readings on this, that notion, Helen's having a struggle here with helping Bill. She's being asked to help Bill. She's being told to help Bill. She resents it. She wants Bill to help her. And she has a number of back and forths with Jesus on this topic. And he keeps pulling her back to, you need to help him, and we all need to work together on this. And sometimes she's far more comfortable with that. And as time went on, I think she did become more comfortable with that. Okay. I think that's all I wanted to say on this topic. Carmen notes that another possibility of Helen had some background about which doesn't seem to have anything to do with her 20th century biography at all. Okay, I'm going to give it back to you. Here.
Continuing on here with 41K, so that's T1B 41K. Equality does not imply homogeneity. Now, when everyone has everything, individual contributions to the sonship will no longer be necessary. When the atonement has been completed, all talents will be shared by all of the sons of God. God is not partial. All his children have his total love, and all his gifts are given freely to everyone alike. 41L. Except to become as little children, in quotations, means unless you fully recognize your complete dependence on God, you cannot know the real power of the Son and his true relationship with the Father. Doug.
This relates to, I believe we read it last week, Jesus saying that he's in charge of space and time, and he's an elder brother, and his role is different from ours only in time. And here we get the same theme repeated. Equality does not imply homogeneity now, but when everyone has everything, when the atonement is completed, individual contributions to the sonship will no longer be necessary. And all talents will be shared by all of the sons of God. But here in time, when we still think we're in time anyway, and we still think of ourselves as separated, the miracle is needed for the healing process to bring the atonement about, and represents an exchange of those who temporarily mourn on behalf of those who temporarily have less. And here again, he's using the theme of children. All of his children have his total love. And in the last reading last week, that metaphor of children was being used as Jesus explained to Helen and Bill that many children who are already physically born need to be spiritually born and will be sent to Helen and Bill, who will essentially be their spiritual parents. And then the whole parent-child relationship is also discussed as a metaphor to illustrate this healing, nurturing, helping, teaching relationship that's going on between himself and us, basically. And these family relationships of father, brother, parents, children are frequently used to characterize the relationship between the divine and the human. And here we have another example. And I love this line, except you become as little children, which is a quote from Matthew 8, which is, assuredly I say unto you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. It means, unless Jesus is telling us here, unless you fully recognize your complete dependence on God, the way children recognize their dependence on their parents, for instance, you cannot know the real power of the Son in his true relationship with the Father, which would be entering the kingdom of heaven. Okay. Now Carmen is writing, Ezra is an alternate spelling for Ezra, silver, and Jesus seems to have addressed how it is Ezra several times in the dictation. Yeah, Jesus does use the name Ezra twice in the notes to, and I think once actually in the Urtext, text, he got in to, I forget, I don't know, I think it's only in the notes, to refer to Helen. Now, Ezra is actually a contemporary Arabic name that means pure, and it's an ancient Hebrew name that means, I looked this up yesterday, what does it mean? I believe it means maiden. Maiden, yes. And it could also be an alternate spelling of the Hebrew name Ezra. So Ezra typically is more of a male name, whereas Ezra is typically more of a female name. But beyond that, I don't know where the Ezra came from. So Ezra, we're now on top of page 47 for those who are following along online. And I'm going to post the link again in just a moment and then it starts reading P1B41M.
So 41M, you and Bill do have special talents which are needed for the celestial speed up at this time. But note that the term speed up is not one which relates to the transcending of time. I don't know what that means. Care to share?
Nope.
Do you know what that means?
I think the next paragraph will explain it. And if not, then ask me this.
Okay, cool. 41N. When time is abolished and all the sons of God have come home, no special agents will be necessary. But do not underestimate the power of special agents now, or the great need there is for them. I do not claim to be more than that myself. No one in his right mind, a term in brackets, is a term which should be specially noted, ever wants either more or less than that. Those who are called on to witness for me now are witnessing for all men, as I am. I'm going on to 41. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay. I'm not sure if that answers your question. The term speed up is not one which relates to the transcendence of time, or the transcending of time. By that I mean, he really means speed up. That things are going to be happening faster as opposed to moving out of time entirely. And then in the next paragraph, when time is abolished, i.e. transcended, and all the sons have come home, no special agents will be necessary. Special agents. and he considers himself a special agent. Do not underestimate the power of special agents now, the great need there is for them. I do not claim to be more than that myself, or a special agent in time to help us speed up getting to the transcending of time. And no one in his right mind wants, ever wants, either more nor less than that to help in that speed up. That's how I think of it anyway. And back to
Thank you, Doug. 41.0. The role of the priestess was once to experience revelations and to work miracles. The purpose was to bring those not yet available for direct revelations into proper focus for them. Heightened perception was always the essential priestess attribute. 41P. The whole little P is in brackets. This is the first time that Helen Schuckman ever said that she would be honored if there were any notes. This is the first time that Helen Schuckman ever said that she would be honored if there were any notes. We'll go on for Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, I think this one's kind of interesting because initially, in the material we've been reading today, Helen's response to being asked to take notes has been anything but enthusiastic. She's been dragging her feet, she's been complaining, she's done it, but somewhat under protest much of the time. And in explaining the role which Jesus has been doing in the last few pages, she's finally getting around to saying she would be honored to take the notes that she's been instructed to take. And this is a shift for her. She's accepting her role and is accepting it gracefully as opposed to kicking in buttons. Which takes us to P1B41Q.
In brackets, neither Bill nor I is really clear about how sexual impulses can be directly translated into miracle impulses, close brackets. The fantasies that I mentioned yesterday, in brackets, refers to discussion Helen Schuckman and Bill had, brackets, closed, provide an excellent example of how you switch. And in brackets again, now switch the pronoun references or it will be too confusing, close bracket. 41R, fantasies are distorted forms of thinking because they always involve twisting perception into unreality. Fantasy is a debased form of vision. Visions and revelations are closely related. Fantasies and projection are more closely associated because both attempt to control external reality according to false internal needs. Quotation, live and let live, happens to be a very meaningful injunction. Twist reality in any way and you are perceiving destructively. Reality was lost through usurpation, which in turn produced tyranny. I told you, you were now restored to your former role in the plan of atonement. But you must still choose freely to devote your heritage to the greater restoration. As long as a single slave remains to walk the earth, your release is not complete. Complete restoration of the sonship is the only true goal of the miracle-minded. And we're going to be swinging to the top of page 48, and here's the mic, Doug.
Yeah, that first paragraph about how sexual impulses can be directly translated into miracle impulses relating to a discussion yesterday, I'm not sure whether we have a record of that discussion in the previous pages or whether Helen and Bill had a chat about it and are now asking Jesus about it. It's not clear to me. And the pronoun switching, I'm not sure what that's about either. The next paragraph about fantasies visions, revelations, and projections, and how closely related they all are, is apparently the answer to the question about how sex impulses can be directly translated into miracle impulses. And fantasies are distorted forms of thinking. Fantasies is a base form of vision. Visions and revelation are closely related. Fantasies and projection are more closely associated. And the issue here in the conclusion of that paragraph seems to be that we need to be very careful to stay tuned into reality and essentially avoid fantasy. And there's going to be a lot more in future pages about fantasies and their dangers in terms of distorting perception and disconnecting us from reality. And I think that the core of the confusion between the miracle impulse and the sexual impulse, which has been discussed extensively and will be discussed some more, is just that fantasy tendency to, as Jesus says, the willful mind will seek what is the gratification or expression of the miracle impulse in sexual gratification or orgasm. And the miracle impulse isn't about orgasm. it's the clear, unequivocal statement being made in this kind of thing. But in our fantasies, well, yeah, sure, why not? And in that process, reality gets all twisted, and we're perceiving destructively, and reality gets lost. And then, top of page 48, more about sexual fantasies, and some fairly useful information here. So, take it away, Deborah.
Okay, so we're at 41S. Sexual fantasies are distortions of perception by definition. They are a means of making false associations and obtaining pleasure from them. Man can do this only because he is creative. But although he can perceive false associations, he can never make them real except to himself. As was said before, man believes in what he creates. If he creates a miracle, he will be equally strong in his belief in that. The strength of his conviction will then sustain the belief of the miracle receiver. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, the thing that strikes me in this paragraph is really worth drawing attention to is that we believe in what we make or create. If we make false associations through fantasy, and we can do that because we have our minds are creative, we can never make them real but except to ourselves, but man believes in what he creates. So we can believe in our fantasies. We can believe in delusions, and I'm sure we've all met people who do. And the belief in something has no connection whatsoever to the truth of that something unless there has been a process of reality testing. We tend to believe whatever we want to believe. Basically, it's how human perception works. But that has a positive aspect too, because in performing miracles, we will believe in them as well, and the strength of that conviction will sustain the belief of the miracle receiver. So that tendency has both positive and negative connotations. Okay. 41C. Take it away, Deborah. Okay, Deborah, I didn't see you pick up the mic there. Just wondering if you're having trouble. So I'm going to read this next paragraph and put up your hand when you are there again. Oh, there you are. Okay. Here's the mic.
Okay, thanks. I guess it didn't take. So I'm sure I had clicked on that. So we're at 41T. Mm-hmm. No fantasies, sexual or otherwise, are true. Fantasies become totally unnecessary as the whole satisfying nature of reality becomes apparent. The sex impulse is a miracle impulse when it is in proper focus. One individual sees in another the right partner for, in quotations, procreating the stock. And in brackets, Wolf was not too far off here, close bracket. And also for their joint establishment of a creative home. This does not involve fantasy at all. If I am asked to participate in the decision will be a right one too. So Jesus quite much separates fantasy and illusion. Am I correct in that? And noticing that? That he will ever cross those two terms? To one mean one for the other?
Interesting question. And one I haven't investigated at all. I'm just thinking sexual fantasies, sexual illusions, fantasies, illusions. Yeah, there's a difference here. An illusion is something, generally speaking, which is a mistaken perception. We see one thing and think we see another. For instance, Fred punches Bill and we think we see an attack. That would be an illusion, even if we all agree on it. The reality is, we're seeing a call for love. That would be the truth of this reality. And yes, it can be tested, Amy, and you can tell whether it's a call for love or an attack. And the need to do so is very real. Fantasies, I think, are a little different in that we know when we're fantasizing that it's not real. You know, I imagine myself having a Cadillac automobile, for instance. That would be a fantasy. I know I don't have one. And I may enjoy that fantasy. I might, it might bring me pleasure. The idea of having such a car might bring me pleasure, as an example. That would be a fantasy. But I'm under no illusion that it's real. However, the fantasy indulged in can start to be believed. People can generate fantasies, imagine things, and then start to believe they're true enough to really get themselves quite confused. That would be the distinction I would make there. I don't know if that's useful or what you were asking. Here's something like that.
Yes, it's useful, and I'll go over it in my mind more thoroughly later. 41U. In a situation where you or another person, or both, experience inappropriate sex impulses, know first that this is an expression of fear. Your love toward each other is not perfect, and this is why the fear arose. Turn immediately to me by denying the power of the fear, and ask me to help you to replace it with love. This shifts the sexual impulse immediately to the miracle impulse and places it at my disposal. 41b. Then acknowledge the true creative worth of both yourself and the other one. This places strength where it belongs. Note that sexual fantasies are always destructive, brackets, or depleting, in that they perceive another in an inner hole. Both people are perceived essentially as, quotations, objects fulfilling their own pleasure drives. This dehumanized view of the source of the depleting use of sex. I'll read that again. This dehumanized view is the source of the depleting use of sex. Freud's description is purely negative, i.e., as a release from the unpleasant. He also observed that the tension from id impulses never completely abates. Are you good, Doug?
Okay, I just wanted to comment. I was reading the board there while you were speaking and got myself distracted. Carmen has made a couple of comments that I think are particularly interesting, which reflect what Jesus is saying here about objectification. And the whole idea of sex object versus love. And looking at another, which the ego always does, as a source of gratification or satisfaction or salvation in another body, with emphasis on the physicality. And that can be just as present in looking at, say, a business partner or customer or supplier as a way to make money, someone you can use to get something you want, political alliances, somebody whose friendship you need to get something you want, as somebody who has a body you think can give you some pleasure you want. All of these objectify another in a relationship, become special relationships, and this pertains to the whole discussion of special relationships that occurs later. And it isn't love going on here. There may be love there as well. You may love, you may actually feel some genuine love for a person you're relating to in an objective way, or an objectified way. But to the extent that you're viewing the person as an object, and even to some extent, to the extent you're viewing them as a body, it's specialness, not love. And it's not relating to the whole person. It's only relating to a portion of that person in blocks, the love and the miracle from fully developing in that relationship. And Carmen writes, all addictions are just attempts to get the same feeling as real joining without the danger of actually joining with another. Fascinating insight, Carmen. thanks for that. This takes us to the bottom of page 48, top of page 49, T1B 41W. I don't know, Carmen, if you want to talk about that, that just strikes me as such an interesting idea. I'll hand you the mic if you have something more to say. Just signal me. All right, I'll drop the mic and either, all right, there you are.
Okay, let's tackle this for a second. This is a huge piece of information that I don't think you've gotten to yet, but it's the section on fixation. And Jesus tells them that it's one of the more fascinating theories of Freud about fixation. That people are almost genetically geared to be fixated on something. And we were actually created to fixate it on God. And I took that into meditation to see if he could give it to me a little bit clearer. And what I got was, this is the source of all of our addictions. We were literally created to be addicted to God / love. And when we turned our backs on God / love, God himself and God as being ever present in front of us in the form of our brothers and sisters, when we turned our backs on that and blocked it, he created this hunger inside of us, because this is what we were created to do, is to receive this love constantly. And it's interesting to me that if you think about it, that you were created to have this addiction to love, that it takes away the guilt associated in our society, and I'm sure in every other society, with every addiction. And, you know, some of the addictions are more socially acceptable than others, but the ones that our society comes down on especially hard, it was brought up here about sexual addiction and fetishism, and, you know, there's all sorts of things that have an awful lot of guilt overlaying on them by our society. If you understand that you were created to be addicted, and if you stop the addiction, if you change the behavior through controlling the behavior, you're just going to switch to another addiction. And, you know, the course talks about not addressing behavior, because that's a symptom. You have to address the cause. Well, the cause of all addictions, apparently, is that we were created to be addicted to love / God. And I think that's one of the basic premises of the 12-step programs, is that guilt, just like in the course it says guilt is the great anchor of time, guilt is one of the great anchors of addiction. So if you can just let go of the guilt surrounding your addiction, you're a huge step closer to healing it. So I wanted to take just a moment to share that. So I hope that's been helpful to somebody. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that, Carmen. Yeah, that is a very interesting insight into that segment, which I think we left, with that little description of Freud at the bottom of page 48, and I'm not going to go into commentary on Freud and his ideas about sex at this point, unless somebody really begs me to. I think it's not terribly helpful, unless you're a student of Freud, which incidentally Helen and Bill were. Okay, top of page 48, T1B 41W. Take it away, Deborah.
Okay, so it's actually flipped over to 49. So 41W, what he should have said is that the shift from miracle impulses to sexual impulses was debilitating in the first place because of the level confusion involved. This set up a state in which real release was impossible. Note also that Freud's notion of sex was as a device for inducing relaxation, which he confused with peace. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, I just wanted to draw attention to there to a lot of this is still answering the question that Helen and Bill put to Jesus back, I'm looking for it here, a page or two previously, about how to convert sexual impulses into miracle impulses. And what he's talking about is the conversion from miracle impulse to sexual impulse, which he's paying far more attention to as a common problem, where the miracle impulse is mistaken for a sexual impulse. And it involves level confusion, the level confusion of the spiritual or miraculous, which is a universal, to the sexual impulse, which is it's a universal and it's impersonal. The miracle impulse is impersonal. The sexual impulse is not universal and it's very personal and also very physical, obviously. And those are the two levels getting confused there. And that set up a state in which real release is impossible. And then another deviation into Freud, which continues into the next paragraph. 41X, top page 41. Okay, Dad.
Inappropriate sex relaxes only in the sense that it may induce physical sleep. The miracle, on the other hand, is an energizer. It always strengthens and never depletes. It does induce peace, and by establishing tranquility, brackets not relaxation, it enables both giver and receiver to enter into a state of grace. Here his miracle mindedness, bracket not released from tension, is restored. I think miracle mindedness is far beyond release of tension. It's so far encompassing. It's something that's fixed. There's something that has changed. Maybe that word is better. And relaxation comes and goes. My take. 41Y. Tension is the result of a building up of unexpressed miracle impulses. This can be truly abated only by releasing the miracle drive, which has been blocked. Converting it to sexual libido merely produces further blocking. Never foster this illusion in yourself or encourage it in others. An object, in quotations, is incapable of release because it is a concept which is deprived of creative power. The recognition of the real creative power in yourself and others brings release because it brings peace. 41Z. The peace of God which passeth understanding can keep your hearts now and forever. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay, I just wanted to mention that's another biblical quote from Philippians 4. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall guard your hearts and your thoughts in Christ Jesus. And I'm also trying to read Kerman's thing here. And I think it's, once again, Kerman has made a very astute observation. The miracle impulse is the desire to join with another. Miracle impulses are a desire to join with another, possibly, though a great deal of time has been spent by Jesus in the previous pages stressing that miracle impulses are impersonal, generalizable, and applicable to all creation, and are not personal, in contrast with revelation, which is highly personal. Yet, the collaborative relationship tends to be the occasion of the miracle, and of course that's a personal relationship between persons. But the desire to join, generally, join with another, the miracle impulse comes from love, however you cut the mustard. So the miracle impulse is a desire for union, in a sense, and it can easily be diverted into the sexual impulse, which is far less threatening to the ego, because of course bodies can't really join. And so you get basically fake joining instead of real joining. The ego likes that because you can get the appearance of joining and some of the rush, and a physical rush, without actually really doing it. And forming a real loving relationship with another soul. Instead, you're trying to form a relationship with a body. I think that's very important. Okay, I'm trying to read too many things at once here, and I'm getting myself a little confused. We just finished 41Z, the peace of God which passes understanding. And the bottom of page 49, two more little points. Crossing off to the top of page 50. All right, then. Oh, I didn't see Christian's hand up. Okay. I still don't see it up. Oh, there. Now I see it up. Okay, Christian. Here's the mic.
Hello, Doug. Yes, thank you. I was aware that you were taking on too much information, so I put it down again. Anyway, I'm not sure if this question will just lead to more too much information, so I don't want to make it complicated. There's a lot of text on that board, you know. I should just blindfold yourself, really. Douglas, to be honest. Anyway, I'm a little confused between performing a miracle, which you can't do consciously anyway, and therefore I can't see how it can even be discussed. The idea of giving and receiving a miracle between two what appear to be people, and the concept that a miracle is a shift into invisibility. Because when I lose awareness of my body in the world, I'm certainly not aware of other people to send miracles to at the same time. And the miracle principles, to be perfectly honest, seem to describe different activities. And perhaps there are different activities which are miraculous, from disappearing to sitting in the dream and sending vibes to someone and blowing their brains out, to all of which things I've done. But to be honest with you, I find the way that the Course talks about miracles needs some clarification, because I can't even begin the discussion within myself. I don't know if you can help, but to simplify, the question would be, how can you be sending a miracle to someone, and anyway, it's not done consciously? How could you form a relationship miraculously, unconsciously? And what would be the point if you were not conscious of it? And shift into invisibility or lose awareness of your body at the same time? I really don't see the connection. One is relational between two seeming objects or two souls that seem to appear as objects. The other is a disappearance of time and space. So that's the basic conflict I see in the writing. So I wait to hear your miraculous powers of studious application, Mr. Jackson. Thank you so much.
Oh, now I'm laughing. Okay. Interesting comments. First of all, I don't believe it ever says that miracles are unconscious, but that the miracle impulse arises from the superconscious, of which we are not normally conscious, and consciousness is where it registers. So we do in fact become conscious of it. And then it says consciously selected miracles, which are performed without our being told to perform them by Jesus, are ill-advised, because their healing potential is limited, and they may actually even cause trouble. So that doesn't mean that the miracle worker is unconscious of performing a miracle. It means that the miracle impulse does not arise in consciousness. And when it does, we're liable to be misled or misapplying miracles. And as for the shift into invisibility, what I take from that, and I could be mistaken, and if you think I am, say so. But my understanding of that is a shift from focus on bodies and the visible, the tangible, that which can be sensed with our five senses, into the spiritual, like the shift from the physical eye to the spiritual eye. Doesn't imply unconsciousness or non-existence at all. It implies a higher level of consciousness and awareness. The shift from the visible world to the invisible world. The shift from the physical eye, say the sick body I see, the sick and broken body I see, to the spiritual eye, where the perfect, holy, whole Son of God is discerned. And I'm not paying attention to the broken body that's presenting itself to my physical eye. And miracles of healing tend to involve, at least in some cases that I know of, that kind of perceptual shift from seeing the illness and focusing on it to seeing the perfection and the wholeness and focusing on that. The latter is invisible to my physical eyes, but is actually the eternal truth, which the miracle can at times, and at times does, manifest in visible space-time. Now, I'm not sure if that resolves your question or even addresses your question, but that's what I got from Ricky.
Well, that was wonderful. I have to say, you really surprised me there, and I don't mean that out of underestimation of yourself, but out of gratitude, because I actually didn't think, I thought, God, should I ask this question? It could take hours arguing backwards and forwards. But what I heard, excuse me, what I heard literally answered, broke down, and answered everything that I asked. So to be honest, I'm amazed, and thank you so much, Doug. Everything that I understood, I've written on the board in orange. If anyone wants to know what it was, it's all there, and it's amazing. And thank you, that was incredibly clear. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad I was clear for once. Okay, now at the bottom of page 49, crossing into page 50, and paragraph P1B41AA, and Deborah, if you want to read that, that would be very much appreciated.
Yay, thanks, Doug. I was yaying you. And I wanted to point out here what I'm going to be reading. The very first few sentences actually directs, like, there is that Helen's describable abilities was coming out of a past life reference from earlier that we had read today. So, 41AA, there are only two short additions needed here. Your earlier acute problem in writing things down came from a much earlier misuse of very great scribal abilities. These were turned to secret rather than shared advantage, depriving it of its miraculous potential and diverting it into possession. This is much like the confusion of sex impulses with possession impulses. Some of the original material is still in the temple. This is why you became so afraid about Atlantis. Bill has his own reasons. Top of page 50. TD or T1B 41AB. 2. Retain your miracle-minded attitude toward Rosie very carefully. She once hurt both of you, which is why she is now your servant. but she is blessed in that she sees service as a source of joy. Help her straighten out her past errors by contributing to your welfare now. Reba Doug.
Yeah, Atlantis pops up here, the word, for the first and only time. Why you became so afraid about Atlantis, Bill has his own reasons, and this is one of a number of indicators that we're missing material. There's stuff that was recorded or said and not recorded, or recorded and hasn't shown up or was lost. And this is actually from the ear text, not from the notes. There's nothing about that in the notes that I've come across. If anybody else has, by all means, whistle. And I'll just point out that on the document online, the stuff that's from the notes that's not in the ear text is in blue italics. Everything in black, regular type, is ear text. So yeah, here again we have definitely a past life, much earlier misuse of very great scribal abilities, and as Carmen pointed out, that would tend to correspond biographically with Ezra. There's a connection there. This is much like the confusion of sex impulses with possession impulses, which takes us back into the previous discussion of possession. I'm pretty sure it was previous. We've already gone through that. Which has to do with earthbound thought, bodybound thought, and okay, I'm going to just leave that one at that. And then the paragraph about Rosie, who was a lady Helen and Louie employed in their home to be housekeeping. And again, suggesting a past life connection between Rosie and Helen and Louie. She once hurt both of you, which is why she's now your servant. And I don't think this is referring to anything that happened in Rosie's or Helen's or Louis's 20th century biography. Okay, so now we're on to an interesting little snippet from the notes that was not copied into the ear text. Topic page 50, T1B41AC, and four notes and tips. Here. Okay, take it away, Debbie.
AC, special revelation regarding Helen Schuckman, omission 1. 41AC-N1. Priestess, a brother has knelt at your shrine. Heal him through me. 41ACN2. I have an idea that the shrine merely referred to the must be altar, eller within, in quotations, which the priestess served. I imagine that the communication form was direct and the quotations brother always meaningless. I, the priestess, responded automatically by praying directly to God, standing with upraised arms to draw down a blessing on her brother, who knelt outside. Her response was completely automatic and impersonal. She never even thought of checking the outcome, because there was no doubt. 41ACN3. I imagine there is still no doubt, really, except that the priestess can no longer ask alone. 41ACN4. It was originally, in quotations, sister, not, in quotations, priestess.
Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, I find this last line mystifying and intriguing in a number of ways. The whole segment about a brother kneeling at the Edward shrine or the altar within which the priestess served. But that last line, it was originally sister, not priestess. So Helen Hurd's sister wrote down priestess. She was thinking in terms of what that previous paragraph stated about the role of the priestess being to be an intermediary between people, humans, and the divine through her greater sensitivity or ability to draw down the supernatural, the spiritual realm to the physical realm. And in a true miraculous sense would be automatically impersonal. And then that interesting line, she never thought of checking the outcome because there was no doubt. Which is an interesting insight into her understanding of what's going on here in her own experience as her pen is on the paper back in 1965. All right, that's all I have to say on this. And that's the end of that insert in the notes. Take it away, Deborah.
41 AD. Helen Schuckman, question regarding past memories. Answer: as long as you remember always that you never suffered anything because of anything that anyone else did, this is not dangerous. 41 AE. Remember that you who want peace can find it only by complete forgiveness. You never really wanted peace before, so there was no point in knowing how to get it. This is an example of the quotation need to know principle, which was established by the Plan of Atonement long before CIA. 41 AF. No kind of knowledge is acquired by anyone unless he wants it or believes in some way he needs it. A psychologist does not need a lesson on hierarchy. It needs as such, but like everyone else, he does need to understand his own. 41 AG. This particular set of notes will be the only one which deals with the concept of quotation lack, because, well, the concept does not exist in creation of God. It is very apparent in the creations of man. It is, in fact, the essential difference. Take it away, Doug.
Okay, I'm just going to comment here that this point marks a break in the topic and a significant segment on scarcity thinking and the whole idea of lack, which was edited out of later abridgments, though the notion of scarcity thinking wasn't. So when you read the Blue Book, for instance, you come across this scarcity thinking, and what's he talking about? What is this? It was one of my clues before I ever saw the earlier material that there was something missing, because clearly this topic had been discussed and was being referred to as if it were an established, defined subject. And yet there's nothing about it. But here it is. This is the introduction to the idea of scarcity thinking, a notion which will recur in the later text periodically, and it's all referring back to this segment and the ideas presented here. And this is big enough and important enough that it will probably take us to the end of the hour. So that starts at the towards the bottom of page 50, P1B 41 AG, the scarcity fallacy. Okay. Take it away, Deborah. I don't know if you thought you picked up the mic, but you didn't.
Okay, thanks. I just think I picked up the mic. So I'm starting in at 41AH, right use of G. So did you want me to read G over again? Did you have a response there? Yes? Okay. So 41G, or 41AG. This particular set of notes will be the only one which deals with the concept of, in quotations, lack. Because while the concept does not exist in the creation of God, it is very apparent in the creations of man. It is, in fact, the essential difference. 41AH. A need implies lack, by definition. It involves the recognition, conscious or unconscious, in brackets, and at times, fortunately, superconscious, that you would be better off in a state which is somehow different from the one you are in. 41AI. Until the separation, which is a better term than the fall, nothing was lacking. This meant that man had no needs at all. If he had not deprived himself, he would never have experienced them. Here you go, Doug.
Okay, I just want to sort of focus attention on those two ideas because they're very, very simple. Need, our need. As human beings, we have needs. The very fact of having a need implies lack. And a recognition, conscious or otherwise, that we would be better off in a state which is somehow different. Okay, so we're all there. If you have a body, it's going to get hungry. You're going to need food. If you have a body, it's going to get oxygen starved if you don't inhale air. You need to breathe. Our physical experience on the planet is one of need. Until the separation, we're told, which is a better term than the fall, nothing was lacking. That meant that man had no needs at all. And if he had not deprived himself, he would never have experienced it. So, this experience of need is something we have chosen. We have deprived ourselves of everything. And having created that situation, we believe it's true. To refer back to an earlier lesson in this segment. Okay, this brings us to the bottom of page 50, top of page 51. He went the 41AJ. This is such interesting stuff. I love this segment. Okay. Oh, Christian, you have your hand up. Here's the next.
Doug, did you say before the separation, man had no needs? Because that implies, before the separation, there were bodies, which actually doesn't make sense, and bodies had no needs. Or is that just me being overly scientific? You know, before the separation, there was spirit, and it had no needs. But what I heard you say, whether it's what's written in the book, was before the separation, man had no needs.
Well, it does say man had no needs, and it does refer to the fall, which we read about in Genesis chapter 3, where at the point of the fall, there was a man and there was a woman in the Garden of Eden, in that myth, in that story, having bodies and eating fruit. They'd already been given the planet. They'd already been given the fish in the sea and the animals on the earth and the plants as food. And then they met the serpent. And something happened. So that particular story in Genesis is referred to repeatedly in the early chapters of the course and explained in somewhat intense detail. But there's nothing specific that I can think of that implies that bodies, I shouldn't say implies, that necessitates the concept that we didn't have bodies before the fall. So it's not a question I've ever actually thought about. I don't have a whole lot to say on it, except I can't think anything offhand that would necessitate that interpretation. And it does say this meant that man had no needs at all, but the word man or human or even woman or person doesn't necessarily imply body either, because when he talks about our eternal nature and the fact that we are not bodies, he's not saying we're not humans. And it's certainly my understanding that humans periodically have, humans are eternal souls, eternal humans, who periodically have bodily experiences when needed for the training of our mind. So I don't see any problem or any I don't see it as necessarily meaning that the fall precedes or succeeds bodies when we use the word man. It doesn't necessarily imply to me anything to do with bodies. But others may have other ideas. And I see two hands up. I don't know which was up first. You guys do, so whoever was up first, here's the mic.
Thanks for the thought. I imagine for just about every person on the planet, the word man implies a body. I don't see any separation between the word man and body, but I think that in the context in which you are working, there is a lack of specific distinction in that regard. And so I think the word man is being used uncertainly in the earth text, because you just said you don't know whether before came before or after bodies or we've had any deep bodies. Actually, it doesn't really, the fall or the separation doesn't really have anything to do with bodies. Bodies just an after effect of the idea of separation, which is performed by the mind. So I guess in that sense, I would find some closing of the gap. Anyway, I just had a little vision while you were talking, a mini vision of. You're looking at it in the context of the serpent in the Garden of Eden. What I was showing is that the serpent, in the context that you're now Adam and Eve, and you've got these bodies, and everything's great in the Garden of Eden, you've done the separation, you're not suffering too much, you're just mindless, but not really suffering. But then the mind, what I was just shown was made a further attempt to split and to concretize the split, which was just as huge, other than forming a dream world, which was to form needs and so on in the body. And that was a deliberate attempt of the mind to, I guess you could make a dream, but you'd have to make yourself one with the dream and actually experience it. And that's what I was seeing as the serpent, the further decision of the mind, the further descent into hell to create needs in the bodies or body. Thank you.
Okay, Boris, you've got your hand up. Thanks, Christian. I want to hear what Boris has to say, and then we'll try to come back to all of it.
Yes. I mean, I, you know, from doing this course for all these years, I don't see man at all in any way connected to the body. As Jesus would say, it really wasn't a problem for me. God's son. And even in the Bible, I don't, you know, these people that were walking around in the Garden of Eden were not human beings in bodily form. These were just ideas, concepts that were put in there. So whether you read them in the future can understand a little bit more about how God had only one son and how a separation occurred. And the idea of bodies, to me, is not relevant at all. And I pulled up, you know, as I recommend my favorite dictionary, you know, because I pulled up man, because some people do believe that man is a body, and I don't see it at all. And down there, again, I think this Merriam-Webster's is just Christian Science. It must be this is the definition of man, according to Christian Science. The compound idea of infinite spirit, the spiritual image and likeness of God, the full representation of mind with a capital M. So when Jesus, I was talking about man, I mean, I don't see the body at all.
Yeah, Boris, thank you for that. My understanding of the word is similar, that I believe I'm a man, and I don't believe my being a man has anything to do with having a body, except that it's in the nature of men to sometimes have bodily experiences in eternity. So yeah, that's also my understanding of the word, that it doesn't necessitate the concept of a body being present in space and time. As for the Garden of Eden story, well, the story, the way it goes, is that the material world was created. Planet Earth was actually, it's there at the beginning of the creation story, but was without form and void, and the Spirit of God moved upon the surface of the earth, and from that movement of the Spirit, land was separated from seas, day and night, the stars in the sky, the animals and the fish and the plants, and finally the end, Adam and Eve, whose every need was met in the garden. And then they came up with this idea that they were going to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which I read as learning how to make judgments, learning how to judge from the ego rather than in direct communication with God, because it says they were in direct communication with God to start with. And as they learned to judge, they step into a separation from God. And what immediately happens in the story of the garden after that is that they try to hide from God. And that is the biblical account. And I don't think very many people understand that to be a literal history so much as a metaphorical description of a mental process whereby judgment occurred. And whether or not bodies preceded or succeeded, I don't know. I honestly don't care. It's not a question that interests me very much at this point. So I'm just trying to quickly read the board here. Well, it was done in the mind, yes, for us. The decision to start judging and determine right from wrong and essentially invent an illusory world of sin was done in the mind. Whether it was done in minds that happened to inhabit bodies or not, I don't know. And I don't even know how we could know. But we do know that after the separation, needs became the most powerful source of motivation for human action. And again, I don't know if that human action is confined to action within bodies, or if we believe in reincarnation and periods of time spent between physical incarnations, it applies there also. I don't know. And the course really doesn't address it. This would be the top of page 51, P1B41AJ. And I just read the first line of that paragraph. And remember, I would be tempted to pick up at that point.
Sure will. All behavior is essentially motivated by needs, but behavior itself is not a divine attribute. The body is the mechanism for behavior. Brackets, ask any behaviorist, and he's right, too. Close bracket. 41AK. You tell your own classes that nobody would bother even to get up and go from one place to another if he did not think he would somehow be better off. This is very true. 41AL. Believing that he could be better off, in quotations, is the reason why man has the mechanism for behavior at his disposal. This is why the Bible says, in brackets, by their deeds ye shall know them. Close quotations. Jesus keeps referring to the body, in my mind, as something that is not fully our construct. And we project onto it. That's what when he talks about the way he's talking in these sentences, that's what keeps coming to mind to me. The body, while misperceived, can be mistaken as a mistake from God. In my opinion, is what Lee has posted here. So I guess that's something to really keep in mind. While misperceived, body, while misperceived, can be mistaken as an escape from God. Okay, I'm taking this in. I'm going to continue reading. 41AM. A man acts according to the particular hierarchy of needs he establishes for himself. His hierarchy, in turn, depends on his perception of what he is, i.e., what he lacks. This establishes his own rules for what he needs to know. Take it away, Doug.
This is getting more interesting than I anticipated. The body, while misperceived, can be mistaken as an escape from God, right? The body is just an image in the mind. The body is an illusion we make to hide from God. Adam and Eve are symbolical representations for the spirit and soul. We have here a whole bunch of different ideas about what a body is. And those are just a few of the ones that have come up in the last 20 minutes. The Course says a whole lot about bodies. One is that it's a separation device. Two, that its only function is communication. Three, that it's a learning device created by God for the training of our minds. What it is, what anything is for, is what we use it for and how we see it. And if we see it as something that keeps us apart from God, as many people do, including many Course students, that as long as I'm in a body, God can't see me and I can't see God. And I'm stuck in a godless realm where God's presence is not. That is one view, and it's not restricted to Course students. There's another view that the body is given to us as a learning device, provided for us. The Course says numerous things to that effect. One of them we read just recently, I think it was last week, that it'll the body gives a soul an opportunity to improve its record, consistent with the learning device. Elsewhere in the course, it says the body's only function is communication. And if we see that as true and use the body for that, then the body becomes a means to convey information or communicate to those who cannot communicate with the divine directly. Bodies are presented in a variety of different ways, and depending on whether you're looking at it from the ego, which the ego uses the body for, the ego uses the body for itself. To the ego, I am a body. Period. To the Holy Spirit, the body is a communication device provided not just for our personal benefit and learning, but as a communication device in a generalizable, impersonal way. It's an instrument for communication and miracle working. Bodies can be quite a number of things. And so with worlds. I mean, we hear an awful lot about the world in Course circles, but very few make the distinction between the two very different worlds the Course describes. One being real and divinely created, and one being illusory and a nightmare dreamed up by the ego that serves to hide the truth, basically. And I think that the whole point here, and the central core, is anything is what you make of it. And in the hands of the Holy Spirit, will be used to advance divine purposes. And in the hands of the ego, will be used to sow confusion. And to try to move beyond that and find some absolute essence independent of what it's used for or how it's perceived, I'm not sure if that's theoretically possible, but I'm very sure it's probably not very useful. So I'm not necessarily keen on even trying to go there. And if anybody has anything to say on that by way of comment, I'm certainly willing to listen. By their deeds ye shall know them. Actually, the only biblical quote I was able to find that corresponds to that is, by their fruits ye shall know them. Which basically is another way of saying, people can say anything they want, but what they do or the fruits of their labors will tell you what they really mean, what's really honest and sincere about them. Regardless of what they say about their intentions, the results of what they do is the reality by which ye shall know them. And then elsewhere in the Course it says, by their fruits ye shall know them, and they shall know themselves. Adding, and they shall know themselves, to the biblical quote, which is a whole interesting, fascinating topic, that it's not just others know us from our actions, but we know ourselves, whether we admit it or not. Alright. And I believe that takes us, I think we've left off there at 41 a.m. Deborah? We've got 16 minutes left. All right, take it away, Deborah.
Okay, I had us starting at 41 a.m. But I can read 41 a.m. as well. I'm not sure what you meant for me to take over there, Doug. So I can start in at 41 a.m. I will do it. A man acts according to the particular hierarchy of needs he establishes for himself. His hierarchy, in turn, depends on his perception of what he is. i.e., what he lacks. This establishes his own rules for what he needs to know. 41 A.N. Separation from God is the only lack he really needs to correct. But his separation would never have occurred if he had not distorted his perception of truth and thus perceived himself as lacking. 41 A.O. The concept of any sort of need hierarchy arose because, having made this fundamental error, he had already fragmented himself into levels of different needs. As he integrates, he becomes one, and his one need becomes one accordingly. Only the fragmented can be confused about this. Well, are we all confused then? I think I had a question in there, and I don't know what my question is. Okay, if it was clear, I'm going to read this little paragraph again and see if my question comes up. The concept of any sort of need hierarchy arose because, having made this fundamental error, he had already fragmented himself into levels with different needs. As he integrates, he becomes one, and his one need becomes one accordingly. Only the fragmented can be confused about this. My question is, what is the integration? What are we integrating here? Thanks.
Okay, that's a really good question. First of all, the hierarchy of needs he's talking about here, something that every psychologist would know, and those who haven't studied psychology may not have run into Maslow's hierarchy of needs that starts with food and shelter and clothing at the bottom. Everybody needs food, shelter, clothing. And at the top is the need for self-actualization. In between are things like community, relationship, meaningful work. I haven't looked at it in 30 years. I forget how many points there are on it, but I'm pretty sure that's what we're talking about here. So a man acts according to the particular hierarchy of needs he establishes for himself. So each of us defines what I need. What do I need? And my hierarchy of needs, my list of things I need, from most important, non-debatable, to would be nice, but I can get through today without it, that hierarchy depends on my perception of what I am. And that depends on my perception of what I lack. That establishes my rules for what I need to know. Now that's a really interesting takeoff on Maslow. Everyone acts according to the particular hierarchy of needs he establishes for himself. His hierarchy, in turn, depends on his perception of what he is, i.e., what he lacks, the equation between what I lack and what I am. And that establishes his own rules for what he needs to know. Fascinating. But separation from God is the only real lack, the only lack he really needs to correct, because all others get corrected from that. But the separation would never have occurred if he had not distorted his perception of truth in the first place and thus perceived himself as lacking. So it's the ego's closed loop. You can't get there from here within the ego's thought system. There's no exit. So the concept of any sort of need hierarchy arose because, having made this fundamental error of perceiving himself as lacking, he had already fragmented himself into levels with different needs. So that means, I mean, the basic level confusion is body-spirit. So I believe my body needs something that my spirit can't deliver. I believe that overcoming the separation from God won't put dinner on the table. I have to take care of that, so I'm pregnant. And I think of different levels of needs that have to be met in different ways. That's the disintegration, the fragmentation. As he integrates and recognizes that everything I am comes from my relationship with God, and every problem I experience comes from my walking my relationship with God, that's integration. He becomes one. Miracle-minded is the same thing. And his one need becomes one accordingly. And that one need is overcoming the separation from God, reuniting with God through my brothers. And only the fragmented, who don't recognize that, can be confused about that. That's how I understand that paragraph. And just quickly reading the board here. And I'm going to hand the mic back.
Okay, I don't know if I've got this. I've been reading and listening, and then my computer sounded it dropped something, and I was hoping it wasn't my mic, and I don't think it was. Nobody's saying, I can't hear you. So I'm going to put in my own words here, which I had written a bit on the board, Doug, and if that coincides with what I'm reading in the Course in Miracles right now, then I get it. If it doesn't, then I don't get it. So in the transformational psychotherapy technique, what we do with client distortions or fears, then we reach in behind and help them to bring out what we are, the love that's there, and integrate that into who they are, into their concept of who they are, and then into their daily living. So it's just really concise the way I'm saying it, but that's basically a crux of the way I see it. So is that what you're saying?
Maybe. But what I heard you say didn't tell me what's disintegrated or what needs integration. And what's being said here is the disintegration is separation. The idea that we are separate from God. That's the only thing that needs fixing. And the integration is of the levels, the physical and the spiritual level, to recognize that all needs, or that there are no lacks except those that derive from separation from God. Okay? So the integration is to integrate the two levels of perception. Ego and spirit, or bodily and supernatural, however you want to label them, so that we recognize, I mean, the miracle-mindedness. What is miracle-mindedness? It is to recognize that all needs, all problems can be solved by the miracle. And everything comes from God. And therefore, every problem is a result of a separation from God, and every solution is simply the reunification or the restoration or the integration of what seem like separated elements, body and soul. In fact, they're one. And the paragraph AO goes into that. As he integrates, he becomes one, and his one need becomes one accordingly. But in the separated state, we think we're two. We think that the body and soul are separated, and even at war with each other. And from the ego's point of view, there is no soul, or if there is, it's just an abstract concept. It's practically meaningless. It doesn't mean anything in the here and now. The two realities are radically separated. Well, Amy, he just acknowledged it right there in what we just read. Sorry you didn't get it. Yeah. Anyway. Did that get at your question, Deborah?
Yeah, it's somewhat coming together. I'm looking for references in my own way of putting things together in my mind, and it's just there's a lot that it seems to be fragmented into and then pulling back together again. So I think I'm on the verge of getting it or comprehending. Anyways, is there anybody else that needed to comment here or question before I start reading? Christian, go ahead.
I just wanted to know we've got 4 minutes left, Christian, so this is going to have to be succinct so we can have time to wrap up, okay?
I had this little experience earlier where I was practicing. I've been practicing the course very intensively this year. So every lesson, every day, exactly as it's written. And I had an experience where I became spiritual light in the room that had nothing to do with the body. It was completely separate to the body. But I was still perfectly well aware of the body and could operate it and feel through it, but it had no meaning whatsoever. And I knew that if I were in a room with another dead body that seemed to have great meaning to me, I would still be in an incredible state of joy because of my oneness with God. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I think that would be an example of integration where the body's needs no longer clamor at the mind and are met. Such that the perception is one of a state of no need, no lack, with or without the body. The body becomes essentially insignificant, as I'm understanding it anyway. But we are now out of time. And Jewel will be here shortly, I believe, from Victoria on Vancouver Island, and I would like to thank everybody for your presence, for your questions, for your attention. This is just really great stuff, and I appreciate this so much, and I hope you've enjoyed the session. And I'm going to hand the mic to Deborah for her to give her goodbyes. Here you go, Deborah.
Hey, thanks, Doug, for allowing me here to be helpful. And thanks, everyone. This is always such a slice. All my love. And take care. Bye.